Welcome to the Funded Now What podcast with your host, Andrew Lee Miller, brought to you by Growth Experts. You are in store for a chat about funding, marketing, startups, and all things growth.
All right, everybody. Hello and welcome back to the Funded Now What podcast. I'm super excited because I've got Paul Meinshausen here, the founder and CEO of AMP. This is Paul's second startup, at least. His last company sold for over $140 million, and he just raised $7.5 million for AMP. And so we're super excited to have him here. Paul, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks, Andrew.
As a marketer, I'm super excited about hearing more about this tool. Essentially, it is an AI tool that helps marketers create individual customer conversations and journeys. So, Paul, tell us a little bit more about AMP and what you guys are setting out to do in the market.
Yeah, so we're very focused on the mobile consumer businesses. And the key thing is that both from a marketing and product perspective, our job as businesses is to create experiences for people in the world, solving whatever task we're solving. Let's say we're a fitness app or an entertainment app. Really, any job is creating an experience for a person in the world to help them make a decision, to help them improve their life in some way, maybe through buying something, maybe through experiencing something. And what we do when we build apps is to create those experiences, to create the content that facilitates decisions. These are really just ultimately human experiences. And so what AMP is about is letting product and marketing folks create better experiences by making that whole process more scalable. So ultimately you create a very unique experience for every end user. And so a lot of that has to do with the mechanics of how AI works, but ultimately from a human perspective, it's really just creating better experiences.
Love that. And it's something that's very hard to do for early stage companies. And so having AI there to help customize messaging and, you know, identify what to say to the right people can really, you know, make that leap much easier. What exactly does the tool do? Am I right in thinking that it's, you know, messaging and, you know, it'll pick this message for that user because they liked this thing previously or engaged with this feature? Is that kind of how it works, or give me a little more product?
That's a fundamental use case. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key thing is that living in 2024, right, we have more ways to spend our time than ever before in humanity and in human civilization, right? So what that means is that like any particular business can offer hundreds, thousands, really even millions of potential pieces of content, ultimately of products. And any given person isn't interested in that full scale, the inventory of a Walmart, of a Netflix. You don't care that Netflix has 30,000 shows, 100,000 shows. It doesn't matter because you're only watching one at a given time.
Right.
And what that means really is that like ultimately we want a more concise experience. So we want to get to the point faster. I think there's nothing more painful for me than when I'm going to think about a Friday evening watching a movie and I end up watching 20 trailers and never watching an actual movie because you don't find it, right? And you're overwhelmed with choice. And so a message is a context, is a user interface that we're all familiar with. It's small, it's to the point. You can kind of help a business go from offering a full massive inventory to offering a simple message that suggests two or three pieces of information, two or three movies that a person might be interested in watching.
Nice.
And so how do you generate that message from that large inventory? It's very specific. So we don't want to send a million people a message that says, hey, come back and check out our app because we've got lots of movies. Oh. They already know that. That's why they downloaded the app. What they want to know is which movie should I watch today, right now, or in 3 days on a Friday.
Personalization.
Yeah.
Nice. And is personalization a big part of that, or like what, you know?
Right. Yeah. So personalization is just a way to describe that whole process. It's just ultimately what it means is I got a message that was specific to my context that took into account things I've watched before, how I've searched before, but also how I've been messaged before. And really it's about making the machine and the computer and the application perform and learn about you as a person faster than ever, more similarly to how we learn from about each other. Right. Ultimately, that's what we're good at doing. If you're a good listener, you're listening to someone, you're hearing what they are interested in, you're like, you know what? I think you'd really like this movie, right? That we want our software to do something similar.
Understood. So what led you to this? I know you have a data science background. Your last company was in the fintech space. What led you to, you know what, we need to use AI to revolutionize marketers' experiences, customizing messages for their users. By the way, thank you for that.
I mean, I think about it for marketers, but I also really think about it for the end person. I almost, it's like marketers, we're servants of our customers. Absolutely. Right? Our job is to make that person
create value,
a better experience, right? It's to create value. Exactly. That process of understanding how we make decisions as people is something that I've always been interested in. That my background is in what's called computational social science and cognitive science. I did research in that area. I went right out of grad school to work for the U.S. Department of Defense, really focused on the war in Afghanistan in the late 2000s, and to try to build technology that would let us make better decisions about why people in a war would decide to plant a bomb, for example. So kind of went back into academia and then realized that I just really love building. And so academia is more about building frameworks to understand people, I think. But actually, what we've realized is as science progresses, it gets more and more practical. I don't think it's actually progressed. So a lot of forms of science of academic research have not progressed. And the evidence of that is that they're not more practical. And so for me, it was like actually data science was a way to take sort of science into the world where we could build better technology to understand people better. That's what my previous company was about in the context of financial technology. And building that application, building that mobile app in India helped me realize so many of the limitations that anyone else might have building their application, and sort of said, well, yeah, we could build applications so much better. And so that's what we set out to do with AMP.
Oh, wow. Makes sense. Yeah. I know I always use the story of FUBU. If you're a founder building it for you, FUBU stands for us, by us. It was a clothing line from 30 years ago, but investors, everybody resonates with a founder solving their own problem first. So you saw how difficult that was. And you're like, oh, we should build a solution to that problem. That makes a lot of sense. And thank you for all that insight. And congrats on such a crazy, varied career from U.S. government to now living in Singapore, working on an app. Now, I did see that you raised from Indian investors mainly, and I thought that was very unique as a dude named Paul from the States. So walk us through a little bit about, you know, I didn't know the previous company was an Indian startup. Tell us a little bit about that and how that led you to raising funding in India this year or last year, actually, at pretty much the most difficult time fundraising in our careers.
Yeah. I moved to Singapore in 2013 when I left academia. I was in Boston. I left and moved to Singapore. Actually followed my wife, fiance at the time. She moved to Singapore to join a startup. I kind of just followed along. And then I sort of I've stayed in Southeast and South Asia ever since. Although I spend a lot of time in the US. It was just sort of a natural progression. I joined a very fast-growing SoftBank-backed startup in 2014 in India. That was a company, one of the first companies that SoftBank invested in.
Wow.
And we grew extremely fast and then in many ways went quite wrong. A somewhat familiar SoftBank story. They take big risks and then, you know, it doesn't always work out. In some ways, I think that's to their credit. In some ways, I think, you know, I learned a lot about how you should use money and how you shouldn't, how you should grow and how you shouldn't.
Yeah.
So then, but then the second company I was really pulled into, my first company that I co-founded was started by a friend who wanted to build for the market in India. He's originally from India, but had, you know, gone to school in the US and built companies in the US, successfully sold it to PayPal and then wanted to build in India. And I was there and we got talking and I built our data platform and our risk platform. And then, so when I went to build AMP, I built it. My co-founders are actually, one of them is Israeli in Paris and the other is American in North Carolina. He'd been at the Department of Defense together. They're both machine learning scientists. So they didn't really know anything about raising money, about the startup world. When we were acquired in 2019, and even a little bit before that, I started to have money in my life. And I wasn't particularly interested in buying a fancy car or that kind of thing. I enjoy the process of building. And so it was kind of very natural for me to take part of that money and to begin to invest. So I started investing in companies around that time. Started investing with a lot of funds out of Asia. Ultimately, now I've invested in companies that have been backed by Lightspeed and Wow. Kotu and Felicis and many in funds in the US as well. Mm-hmm. It's a very natural process, especially for data and AI companies that I tend to invest in, to go to the US and to raise from US funds. When we started AMP, I was still living in Singapore. And so I knew the Sequoia Southeast Asia team quite well, and we had a strong relationship. And so when I told them about what we were building with AMP, right off the bat, just very, very positive. And we're like, we'd love to go on this journey with you. And so we raised from their early stage fund. Since then, Sequoia has split globally into three different funds, one in China, one in Southeast Asia and India, and one in the US, Sequoia in the US, which still operates its Europe kind of piece. And then the other fund we raised from with AMP is called Matrix. They're also another global fund. So Matrix is very well known, top in the world. But I happen to know the investors in the India market. I think when you raise, you want to raise from people that you have a good relationship with, that you have there's trust, there's awareness, et cetera. And I think they're some of the best investors in the world. I mean, incredible companies have come out of India. I mean, it's just an amazing place to build. And I mean, in some ways, I'm more part of that startup ecosystem in India than I am in the US, because that's where it's mostly built and invested and et cetera. So that was just naturally for me. It wasn't like I'm going to go, you know, raise from India. It was just that's the ecosystem that I've
amazing.
Been a part of. Yeah. And
did you learn any Hindi yet?
My wife, actually, her first language is Tamil.
Okay,
yes, I struggle and try to continue to pick up and learn Tamil. When you live in India, you realize it's like Hindi is a very common language, but there's so many others. And so when I was when I was in Bombay, it's like, you know, a lot of people spoke Marathi. And of course, English is usually the language of in the workplace or some mix of that and Hindi. But then when you're in Bangalore, is like South Indian languages. So So my Hindi is not that great, but I can definitely follow along with it.
But you know what paisa means. That's all, you know, so you got the paisa. Awesome. Yeah. What kind of advice would you give somebody listening to this that doesn't have the previous exits and doesn't have like the global experience you have that's approaching fundraising? You know, I think the market's heating up a little bit more now than it was 6 months ago when you raised money. And I'm sure there was, you know, you mentioned you had connections, you had a previous exit, it makes it a little bit easier. You know, do you have any advice for listeners about, you know, first time fundraising, to put you on the spot?
So I'll be honest, like I see a lot of advice proliferating in social media, on LinkedIn, you know, a lot of it has to do with fundraising. And I've always felt slightly off, because I actually think that there's many ways to read this, but I think it's kind of irrelevant. It's beside the point.
Okay.
What I mean by that is that, like, ultimately what you should be thinking about is the business you're building.
Right.
And the problem you're solving for your customers.
That's true.
And I think that from that should follow the questions around who is best positioned to really understand the problem I'm trying to solve, who can bring something to bear beyond the capital,
beyond money. Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And like, if you do that, I mean, capital of course is really important. And I actually I'm skeptical of the whole bootstrap vigilantes, in a sense, like you know, who mock any form of funding, or like, oh, you know, why raise from VCs? Own it yourself. A lot of times, if you get the right investor, what you really should be getting is
network connection. Absolutely.
Like a lot of things that they're bringing to bear that you should want, and that can help you build something incredibly powerful, versus, you know, if really what you want is to never listen to anybody and just kind of have a nice cash business and
that's
a different experience, right? Yeah,
totally.
Exactly.
That's good advice. Okay. So I hear basically first piece of feedback is focus on finding investors that are going to bring a lot more than just money. And that makes total sense. But I want to ask you a question as a data scientist, like, let's just look at the numbers. Like, again, it's easier, I think, when you're coming off of 140 something million dollar exit and you have the background that you have. What? Oh, 195. Okay, thank you for correcting me. Get it right, Drew. Come on.
You know what? It's funny, but if you don't, that's one thing. Is like, unfortunately, when you do realize you have to raise capital, and actually, I think this is more general. True. There's so many in life. There's so much you can kind of get modesty and humility confused with sort of diffidence and an inability to kind of like project your story. Ultimately, the world is incredibly crowded and busy, and everyone's doing something. And so, if you can't push that story forward and really make it clear what it's about and what it was, you miss out, right? So when I correct you on that thing, right, like that's the kind of thing ultimately that investors will be looking for is wait a second. Nope, that's
got to be correct. Yeah, 40. Yeah, we don't want to forget the 50 mil. But going back to my question about the data, like, you know, how at the top of the funnel, you had to reach out to how many companies to get this many terms?
So,
like, yeah, what did that look like for you?
Right. So that's the thing. It's like, that's the kind of concept of like the funnel. And what I'm saying is, if you think about the way I would think about it is you want to allocate your attention over time. And at any given time, you need to be thinking about when you're just getting started, right? You should allocate some amount of times. Let's say I'm going to give it a year. You can give it a smaller amount. You can say, I'm going to see what I can do in a month, but you better be realistic about what's possible to achieve in a month. And if your impatience is such that you've only got a month, then have a great month and then move on. You're not going to accomplish that much, right? And that's okay. So you've allocated some time. So now you say, let's say I'm giving it a year, you need to talk to a lot of potential customers. You need to talk to a lot of people that know the space you're trying to build for. And then some portion of that should be investors. I'm very skeptical of the notion that you should run a campaign where you kind of pull in 100 people and then funnel it down. I think if you're doing that, it's way too much time spent on investors.
That's true.
You can think of it almost like a curve, right? On the x-axis is each incremental investor you speak to, and on the y-axis is how much additional information you learn from that conversation. The first investor, you're going to have a conversation, you're going to learn something from them. Second investor, you're going to learn something from them. Third investor, you're going to learn something from them. Fourth investor, you're going to learn a little less, right?
It just keeps going down. Yeah. So
it asymptotes. It kind of like flattens out. And by the time you get to the 20th investor, you're not really hearing anything much new.
You're just trying to get money. Yeah.
You're just trying to get money, right? And I generally find that personally, that's not how I would want to spend my time as an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So I allocate the year, then speaking to investors is some portion of that, and you spread it out over time. And hopefully if you're learning, you do spread it out over time, because if you're speaking to customers and if you're speaking to prospects and if you're building each month, you're getting new information. So then you can then spend time with that investor in the third month rather than cramming them all into the first month.
Yeah.
What I recommend is that, like, in the process of raising and in the process of building, you should get comfortable reaching out and getting to know people. And that's a hard thing. So if you don't have any background, you don't have any network,
and
you're almost everybody's at that stage at some point, unless, right, like your father was a founder and your mother was a founder, you went to Harvard and you were surrounded by founders. But let's pretend that's not you, because it's not most of us.
Right.
I think it's incredibly positive just for your life to be able to reach out to people and have conversations. And that,
absolutely,
as a founder, like, that's a huge portion of my life. It's finding people and being like, look, what we're building is potentially relevant to you. It's interesting, et cetera. And I think if you do that authentically and you do have something interesting to say and you are willing to listen, then you'll start to have good conversations.
Yeah. And learnings from those conversations.
That's right. And then sometimes they won't be good conversations and they'll be incredibly rude and dismissive and patronizing. That happens a lot with investors. I've also helped raise funds, and you realize that actually a person who's raising money is under incredible amount of pressure. People who are a venture capitalist have a hard time in many ways. And so they are just as ego depleted and nervous and have imposter syndrome, et cetera. And so usually if they're treating you poorly, it's because, man, they're having a tough time. And so I try to be like sympathetic to them rather than
leading with empathy. Love that.
Yeah. And rather than like assume that they're amazing and that they're treating you poorly, it's more like, oh, they're probably not amazing. They're probably having a tough time. So in a way you can feel bad for them. And I think that actually helps you.
Absolutely.
You know, as well. Yeah. I mean, the whole startup world, I use a lot more empathy and
absolutely. I agree with that. I'm just learning all those tools now. And we were taught as young men that empathy is like weakness, and it's not, it's a superpower. Sure. And it can definitely help you forge stronger relationships. But I really love what you said about spreading it out over a year, because I definitely see clients of my own stressing the fundraising. Oh, we're running out of runway. We're burning out. Whereas approaching that 6 months in advance and de-stressing the situation by just making 10% of your calendar valuable conversations. Like you said, you're less burnt out by the investors that aren't great. you know, you'll give them more time, the ones that are great, and that'll probably get the money before it's an emergency situation where you have to give a bad deal for yourself just to get the cash. So that's unique feedback. We've never gotten that. And I really like it because weaving it into your customer conversations, you know, they're all opportunities to get really great feedback. And so you get better and better without bogging yourself down to 100% focus on fundraising, which is often what happens for early stage companies, and product goes to the side. Well, our roadmap gets delayed because the founder's focusing on fundraising. Then the investors see the product's not really ready, and it's a vicious cycle. And so that's excellent, excellent feedback. Let's pivot a little bit to talking about AMP from a marketing point of view. Where are you guys at with like the user base? And you know, you've just got this injection of capital 6 months ago. What are you doing with that from a marketing point of view?
Yeah. So AMP is pretty well established. We have a strong customer base. We kind of went up market early and saw a bunch of large apps in the US. And so we went for deep work with big companies that were willing to pay us a lot.
Wow.
Faster than we did kind of the slightly more traditional way of selling to a lot of people and selling something small. And so our user base, in the sense of the end users who benefit from AMP's infrastructure, is well over 150 million users in a month. Our customer base itself is less than 100.
Yeah.
And so that's just the dynamic of like the kind of technology we're building and where it gets used, et cetera. And I think also a function of our time in our go to market. I mean, we have very small apps using us, but it's not my focus area. No. I'm not trying to market to them because
they barely
the dynamics
need it.
Of it. Yeah. It just,
the AI personalization is when you have 100 million users. It's not feasible any other way to communicate personalized experiences.
That's what I mean is actually the technology works when you're very early. So what I mean is we have really cool apps that are growing really fast, but starting from a very small base. So you can have a few thousand users in a month or using your application, and you should use something like AMP. You should use AMP. It benefits you. And I think it was Sam Altman, I think, or someone similar who recently was like, we expect to see our first, you know, one person unicorn. Mm-hmm. And I do think that I'm seeing some amazing consumer applications that are built by very small teams.
Nice.
And more and more, the software can do the job that you wouldn't historically have a team to do. And the team ends up not doing that well. So it's just more of the function of like for them to discover us as an early stage company requires a certain kind of marketing, a certain kind of sales, a certain kind of product development that we chose not to do. Instead, doing work that facilitated a very large company using us, for example, and the work involved in that. And so it's just a different go-to-market motion. But where we are then is sort of saying, all right, well, now we've done that with several large apps. We do want to, you know, sell to the next 500 large apps. And that is a process of demand generation, because it's the job to be done is not the job that's conventionally done. And so, you know, there's lots of different schematics of sort of like, are you product aware? Are you problem aware? Are you pain aware? And we're often at a place where people don't even realize they have the pain because they say, how do I, you know, retain my users? And you'll get tons of advice and it'll say, do this and do this and do this. Most of which is based on technology that's 5+ years old. It's based on processes that don't make sense anymore that you shouldn't do. But that's the normal way to do it. And so our marketing job now is to shift that broader conversation. There's a famous book called Crossing the Chasm. That concept is very relevant for us. And so now what we're doing is trying to sort of say, how can we generate a broader awareness that there's a better way of doing things? A lot of that comes from facilitating a broader community. So really, mm-hmm. So it's not just us selling AMP.
Right.
They're best in the business. They're best in the world at what they do. And they're pointing to the next 10 people and saying, you really need to check out AMP.
That's the best case scenario is customers bringing in other customers.
In effect, that's the only scenario. If you don't have that, you won't scale.
True.
So that you aim for the best case scenario, because in every other scenario, you die.
Right. If you don't have a product that's delighting people enough to bring in other users, then you're not building the right thing.
That's right.
You know, I see a lot of companies fail in the early stages with going to moonshot huge enterprise clients. Like the business development conversations take too long. The big company doesn't want to try and use a technology that hasn't been proven out, or they lie and they drag out conversations long enough to steal a lot of information and then they build it internally along that. I don't know if you had any of those fears, but how are you able to circumnavigate that and get that done quickly with those huge customers?
Man, that's absolutely right. If you haven't been in the position of buying something like what you're building, it is almost impossible to sell it. And I would recommend you don't do that. Change your go-to-market, change what you're building to reflect a process that you've been able to navigate yourself. Otherwise, it's just you're working against incredibly difficult odds and it just doesn't make sense as a way to allocate your time and attention. I'd built a large business. I'd been VP and chief product officer for a global business. So when I went out to build AMP, the first people I went to validate with were CPOs and CMOs at really big companies. We already knew them, right? So it was just a completely different process. It's Absolutely. Not a generalizable thing.
Yeah.
I was just leveraging off of the world that I knew. Now,
connections.
What's interesting is that 8 years ago, that wasn't me, but what I was willing to do 8 years ago in order to just sort of learn was to reach and speak to those people, be confidently, listen confidently, and then like work my way forward. So if you're building today and you've been in an enterprise, you still need to basically do the thing I described about investors is be willing to kind of go and speak to them. I think it's incredible how willing people are to talk to somebody who reaches out to them in a kind, confident, thoughtful way.
You're here right now.
Yeah. You know what? It's actually quite rare because most people don't do it. And human interaction is kind of the most meaningful thing in life
that we have.
So, yeah. Like who doesn't want more friends, right? And you know, that doesn't mean like 1,000 friends, right? But you're always looking for that next conversation that's interesting, that's insightful, that's thoughtful. And that can be a 20-year-old and that can be a 40-year-old. It doesn't really matter. It just,
correct.
Do you have that confidence and willingness to put yourself out there and get rejected over and over again? Because it'll happen. So I think like those things, but think about it in terms of what's your next step forward,
right?
It's learning how to talk to people. It's learning how to listen, et cetera. It may not be, I'm going to go build a technology and sell it into enterprises, because I think in that context,
you're going to get beat up.
You're going to get beat up. It's going to be super,
it's very hard.
Time and it's very hard, and yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's very, it should always be very contextual. You really Makes have sense. To like pay attention to the context you're in. What are your natural advantages? Or recruiting someone who will join the team, right? And I think that's very similar as well. It's like you are aiming for the best in every context. And so if you do have some really special insight and you know how to build something, a lot of people will end up wanting to build it with you.
Right.
And so your job is just to put yourself into the flow and then reap whatever, you know, opportunistically comes out of it.
Makes sense. Amazing, Paul. Tons of insight there. You tried to act like you didn't have a lot of advice, and then you gave a ton of really valuable and really unique advice from a bunch of different areas, which shows how varied your background has been. You know, when I talk to founders on here, it's a little bit often more cookie cutter, and yours was very unique and really valuable. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here today. I know it's late night in Singapore, so everybody owes Paul a thank you. Where can people find AMP if they want to test it out for their small business? Unlikely that we have a $1 billion enterprise client listening to this, but we can get you some smaller users that might be $1 billion companies eventually.
That's right. That's the key thing. I think I saw that Andreessen Horowitz had a list. I have a list every year of consumer apps. And I think the turnover is incredible. The biggest apps today didn't exist 2-5 years ago. So if you're not thinking about the small apps, then you're really missing out in a very real way. So yeah, I'm very excited about early stage apps. It's hard to target them because you don't know which one.
You don't know which one's going to grow.
But you can find me at us at amp.com, AAMPE.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, on Twitter, or X. Email is just paul@amp.com. I invest quite a bit. I get a lot of outreach. So if I don't respond, it's just because
your message wasn't kind enough.
Not a meaningful indicator for you. And hopefully we'll have a fun conversation one day.
Yeah. Awesome. Just like this. Paul, thank you so much for being here. Get to bed. Really appreciate you. I'll put in the show notes that I'll tag AMP and your LinkedIn so people can spam you and reach out to you with offers and ask for investment at a later time. Thank you so much for being here, man. Cheers. Have a great evening.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, appreciate it.
That has been another episode of the Funded Now What podcast with your host, Andrew Lee Miller, brought to you by Growth Experts. If you liked the episode, please subscribe. And if you really liked it, please share with other founders and entrepreneurs. Thanks, and we'll see you in the next episode.